From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Where is the war on terrorism going next? One of the countries at the top of the list for the U.S. military is the Philippines. Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo is meeting tomorrow with President Bush in D.C. to shop for new military hardware and plan overt and covert military operations involving U.S. troops.
As the Philippine president prepares to meet with President Bush, Filipino activists demand the U.S. get out of the Philippines. 10,000 demand the closing of the U.S. Army School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, saying the main threat of terror comes from military officers trained at the school. And the Pacifica National Board agrees to resign, implement a democratization process for the five-station network. A ratification vote is planned for later this week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. The London Independent is reporting that U.S. warplanes carpet-bombed a densely populated frontline town near the northern city of Kunduz yesterday, killing up to 150 unarmed Afghan civilians. Terrified refugees fleeing the town of Khanabad yesterday told the Independent that U.S. planes had bombed the area a few miles from Kunduz daily since Thursday, seemingly oblivious to the fact that the buildings they were bombing were civilian homes. All day yesterday, huge plumes of smoke rose from the hills on the front lines near the Taliban's last northern stronghold as B-52 bombers continued to drop their loads of bombs. The relentless U.S. pounding appears to have persuaded the Taliban forces to surrender, provided the Northern Alliance fighters pledge not to kill the mostly Arab and Pakistani fighters among them. The Taliban offer was conditional on U.N. representatives monitoring the surrender. In the south, the Taliban remain in control of Kandahar while U.S. jets continue to pound them from the skies. The bombing raids over the past 2 days were described as among the heaviest in 43 days of U.S. attacks. U.S. officials, meanwhile, claim intelligence had narrowed down the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden to 30 square miles in the south near Kandahar. Hundreds of U.S. Special Forces troops are combing the region looking for bin Laden, coordinating U.S. airstrikes and Northern Alliance maneuvers, and engaging in direct combat with Taliban forces. The Washington Post reported in its Sunday edition that the CIA has been engaged in secret combat operations in Afghanistan since September 27th. Secret CIA paramilitary units were the first U.S. forces to enter Afghanistan, preparing the way for U.S. Special Forces and providing the Northern Alliance with intelligence on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The CIA units are part of a highly secret branch of the agency called the Special Activities Division, consisting of small teams of non-uniform men, many of them veterans who have retired from the U.S. military, or former case officers who have local language skills and worked with the Mujahideen in the 1980s. As talks for a broad-based Afghan government look likely to start in Europe this week, U.S. forces have focused their search for Osama bin Laden on the Tora Bora Mountains near Jalalabad in eastern Afghanistan. The alliance's leader, Burhanuddin Rabbani, had insisted that a power-sharing conference could only take place in Kabul, raising fears it intended to dominate the government and exclude the ethnic Pashtun majority. But at a meeting in the Uzbek capital of Tashkent, the alliance's foreign minister, Abdullah Abdullah, bent to U.S. and U.N. pressure and said the meeting will be held outside Afghanistan as early as this week. Militia and warlords associated with the Northern Alliance have reemerged to carve up much of the country into what amounts to personal fiefdoms, posing major challenges to any efforts to restore a unified central government in Afghanistan. In London, chanting slogans and waving banners, thousands of protesters marched across the city, calling for an end to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan Sunday. The Stop the War Coalition estimated 100,000 people attended the march, which they said was the biggest of its kind since the Vietnam War 3 decades ago. and in Kennebunkport, Maine. An estimated 300 people rallied Saturday in front of former President George Bush's summer home. The Maine Global Action Network said they organized the rally to protest the war in Afghanistan. A fourth anthrax-laced letter was sent to Senator Patrick Leahy and discovered in a batch of quarantined congressional mail last week. The letter, sent to one of the Senate's most liberal members and similar to letters mailed to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, adds credence to federal official speculation that right-wing American extremists may be behind the domestic biological terrorism. After dropping all its preconditions for talks with Chechen rebels, Russia opened negotiations today for the first time during the stalemated two-year-old war. And this news from the Philippines: hundreds of former Muslim rebels staged an armed uprising on the southern Philippine island of Jolo, south of Manila, today in a major challenge to the government of the Philippine president. We'll have more on that story later in the program. And finally, dissident and majority members of the Pacifica National Board of Directors agreed yesterday on a formula that would turn control of the network over to an interim board that would set up a structure for democratization of Pacifica. We'll have more on that story later in the program. Terrorist, Public Enemy, featuring Flavor Flav here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday in Columbus, Georgia, 10,000 people from every state gathered to demand the closing of the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning. The schools train thousands of officers from Central and South American countries, and its alumni association reads like a who's who of the hemisphere's worst state terrorists. Former Panamanian dictator General Noriega, Roberto Daubison, the founder of El Salvador's death squads, Guatemala's Colonel Roberto Alpidez, responsible for the torture and killing of Jennifer Harbury's husband, Efraín Bámaca Velásquez, and the officers involved in the murder of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero. More than two dozen people were sent to federal prison last year after committing acts of civil disobedience at Fort Benning, including 88-year-old Franciscan nun Dorothy Hennessy and 19-year-old college student Rachel Hayward. After the September 11th attacks of this year, authorities at Fort Benning sealed off the base and sought an injunction to keep the annual protests from happening, citing the threat of terrorism. Activists say the main threat of terror comes from the military officers trained at the school who commit human rights abuses in their own countries. We're on the phone right now with three people who are part of the protest: Jackie Downing, a senior at Oberlin College, Jeff Winder, co-director of the Washington Office of SOA Watch, and Ray Kramer with the Syracuse Peace Council. She was one of 85 people arrested at the School of the Americas yesterday. Ray Kramer, why don't we begin with you? How did the protest take place?
The protest took place in several ways. Most of the people who were arrested decided to either go under the fence or walk around the edge of the fence that has been installed on the base since September 11th. And one was able easily to do either of those two things. And once around or under the fence, we were informed that we were trespassing, violating specific codes, and would be apprehended. And the soldiers repeated that warning over and over. People chose to continue their walking and were subsequently apprehended, put on buses to be processed on the base.
So you crossed the line?
Yes.
On a bus and arrested?
Yes.
And what happened to you?
Well, we went through what has become a fairly routine processing: photographs, fingerprints. One thing that was interesting is that they had a typed list of all people who have active ban and bar letters in effect, and they checked our names against that list. And I'm sure that was the determining factor in the decision as to what kind of letter people were given yesterday. It seems as if all people who were crossing for the first time received a 5-year ban and bar letter, and those of us who had crossed before and had existing letters in effect were now given a permanent ban and bar letter.
Jeff Winder, I understand the mayor of Columbus and Fort Benning officials sought an injunction to prevent the protests from taking place. What happened?
There had been a lengthy dispute over the permit for our demonstration. We had gone back and forth on different acceptable locations many times. All offers ultimately hinged on our written promise not to organize any march or procession towards the gates of Fort Benning, which we refused to do. We finally received a site for a permitted demonstration, which was 5 miles away from the base, and when we arrived to town for the final days of organizing, 4 of us were served with a summons to appear in court, where in the Columbus Superior Court, where a judge would hear the city's request that we be enjoined from organizing or participating in any march or funeral procession or any demonstration at all within 50 yards of the boundary of Fort Benning property. Represented by the ACLU, we went to court, filed a motion to have that lawsuit moved to federal court because of constitutional issues.
Can you talk about how the September 11th attacks changed this year's demonstrations?
Well, it was shortly after September 11th that we received a call from the mayor's office explaining to us that they had received a call from the commanding general of Fort Benning that the base was on high alert and that our presence posed a security risk there. At that time, the mobilization for global justice, large-scale protests to shut down the IMF and the World Bank was being called off in wake of the terrorist attacks and the inappropriateness of going forward in that time. So there was a lot of confusion in the early days after September 11th as to what this meant for protest movements in general. What we heard from our people all around the country was that they felt it was more important than ever to come here and protest the training of terrorists right in our own backyard at the School of the Americas.
Jackie, you are a student, a senior at Oberlin. You're on the SOA Watch National Board. How did you organize students around the country?
Well, we've been organizing in Oberlin for the last 4 years now, and we do things like show the video documentaries about the School of the Americas, and we invite former prisoners of conscience to come and speak on our campus. And one of these days, we're hoping to get Father Roy to come as well. It's easy to organize students because we're taking so many classes where we're educating ourselves about U.S. foreign policy. And the School of the Americas comes up often in our classes. And then we do activities outside of the classroom to learn about the mobilization.
How have you made connections between the training of the officers from Latin America and the war in Afghanistan?
Well, students know that the U.S. is the largest supporter of terrorism in the world. And that was the first thing that people were on my campus were talking about when the September 11th attacks happened, was that the U.S. actually trained bin Laden. And the immediate connection that people made was to the U.S. training of terrorists at the School of the Americas.
You've worked on Columbia in particular. Can you talk about the School of the Americas and its training of officers from Columbia?
Certainly. I made my first trip to Columbia last January, and I traveled to the Putumayo region, where the U.S. is sponsoring a fumigation campaign to ostensibly kill the coca plant, but they're actually also killing food crops at a much higher rate. And I met a general named General Montoya, who is a 1993 graduate of the School of the Americas, and he is the general in charge of implementing fumigation in the entire Putumayo region. He also has paramilitary connections, and he was trained right here at Fort Benning.
Jeff Winder, can you talk about other people from Columbia and other places that are most recently being trained at Fort Benning?
In February of this year, SOA graduate Colonel Hernan Orozco was sent to prison by a Colombian military tribunal for his complicity in the torture and massacre of 30 peasants in the municipality of Mapiripan. We saw SOA graduate Byron Lima Estrada convicted and sentenced for the brutal 1998 assassination of Guatemalan Bishop Juan Herardi shortly after he released a human rights report indicting the Guatemalan army in the most brutal atrocities of that country's civil war. We saw SOA graduate General Rios Montt, also of Guatemala, face genocide charges in a suit filed by Rigoberta Menchú. SOA graduate Hugo Banzer of Bolivia ordered martial law in April of 2000 and sent the military troops into the streets to suppress dissent as civilians were fired upon for their nonviolent demonstration against the privatization of their water supply and a tripling of their the water prices. And it could go on and on and on. Every country in Latin America where we find human rights violations, we find SOA graduates in the upper echelons of the leadership.
Ray Kramer, was there any discussion at the Syracuse Peace Council, upstate New York, about how protests would change this year? Did anyone have hesitation about going and protesting the military with the bombing of Afghanistan going on?
Well, there's been a strong reaction in the Syracuse community, which has a very long history of protest and civil disobedience going back to the abolitionist movement in the days of slavery. I think the biggest concern for some people was flying, and that deterrent, I believe, held some people back. But between the areas of Syracuse, Rochester, Ithaca, Buffalo, Albany, the whole upstate area of New York State, we probably had close to 100 people come. So overwhelmingly, the decision was, as Jeff stated, far more important to have our presence here this year than ever before. And there was a great deal of solidarity and spirit around that.
Jeff Winder, co-director of the Washington Office of SOA Watch, is there concern that people are going to be dealt with now differently, as in particular dissidents are focused on by the federal government?
There is. This is the first time that we've seen people held on their charges. Usually people are cited out with a court date to return to stand trial. Right now there are 14 people being held on $1,000 bond. This has not happened before. Some of these people are being charged with trespass, even though they do not have a formal ban and bar on their record. This is also new. We're concerned about possible harsher penalties in an attempt to capitalize on a public mood that the authorities perceive as supportive of a harsher crackdown on these type of actions.
After September 11th, the well-known anti-nuclear weapons activist, Philip Berrigan, and his whole Bible study group that was in jail were put in isolation for fear of their effect on the other prisoners. And you also have hunger strikers from SOA Watch, previous protests, who started a hunger strike afterwards.
We have two people fasting in Sheridan Prison in Oregon right now. Their fast concluded today, I believe. They fasted all month in solidarity with the people in Latin America who've suffered at the hands of SOA graduates and people who would be gathering here to protest. Shortly after September 11th, prisoner of conscience for SOA protest Jack Gilroy was called in and questioned, wanting to know what SOA Watch thought of the September 11th terrorist attacks. He told them he could only speak for himself, and they concluded the interview, and he was called back in later. An unknown person had reported him as making un-American comments on a telephone call, and he was threatened with being placed in isolation if he didn't tell them who he had been speaking to and what the conversation was regarding. But that threat was never followed through on.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Jeff Winder, co-director of the Washington Office of SOA Watch. Ray Kramer, Syracuse Peace Council, one of the 85 people arrested at School of the Americas yesterday. And Jackie Downing, senior at Oberlin College on the SOA Watch National Board. And for more information, your website, Jeff Winder?
www.soaw.org.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Philippines. President Bush is going to meet with the Philippine president tomorrow, and we're going to go to the Philippines to learn about what is happening there with rebels rising up. Stay with us.
Ain't got no halo.
Ain't got no halo.
No wings to fly.
Freedom, Nicole C. Mullen, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting from the firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown, right outside a police checkpoint, continues with Army Humvees, U.S. soldiers, National Guard, State Police, and local police. I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile. This is the exception to the rulers. Well, Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo will meet with President George Bush and key U.S. cabinet officials in Washington tomorrow. Elected as vice president, Arroyo was swept into power in January in a popular revolt against the former president, Joseph Estrada. Arroyo and the U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld are expected to discuss the details of a proposed hardware for access agreement when they meet this week, according to State Department officials. Sources say the deal would virtually restore the U.S. government's rights to maintain military bases and troops. Under the proposed agreement, the Philippines will meet, will receive military hardware and supplies in exchange for U.S. access to its former military bases, as well as the transit and short-term stay of its personnel. There's been strong Filipino opposition to the U.S. military bases agreement that allowed the U.S. to operate military bases and station troops in the Philippines. The Philippine government says such an agreement would not be possible because the Constitution prohibits foreign troops in the country. Yesterday, a coalition of more than 15 groups gathered outside the Philippine consulate in New York to greet the Philippine president with the demand that the Philippines not join the U.S.-led, quote, international coalition against terrorism. Among those there was Dave Pugh, member of the Network in Support of the People of the Philippines, and he joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
Can you talk about the significance of the Philippine president's trip to the United States and what she'll be doing with President Bush?
Well, the alleged reason for her trip to the United States is to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Treaty between the Philippines and the United States. But in fact, she's here to offer her country as one big floating U.S. military base for U.S. military operations in Asia as part of the war on terrorism.
And can you talk about what she's going to get for joining?
Well, the a little background is very important. The U.S. had two huge bases in the Philippines up till the early 1990s, Subic Bay and Clark Air Force Base. These were the largest U.S. bases outside the U.S. territory in the world. As a result of a very powerful movement in the Philippines, they were closed down in the early 1990s. Now, the President Arroyo is trying to reverse the correct verdict of that popular movement and enlist the Philippines and the Philippines Armed Forces in the U.S. war on terrorism.
What about the news that hundreds of former Muslim rebels staged an armed uprising on a southern Philippine island today, reneging on a 1996 peace deal and raising a major challenge for the Philippine president's government? Officials said 55 people, 4 soldiers, 51 rebel gunmen were killed in the fighting, which occurred while Arroyo was visiting here to appeal for military aid.
It's very interesting that this event took place during her visit. Now, we haven't had a chance to talk with people back in the Philippines in order to really understand what is going on, but there are a number of different Muslim opposition forces in the Philippines. The group involved in this uprising is called the Muslim National Liberation Front, which had actually reached a peace agreement with the Philippine government 5 years ago in exchange for a little piece of territory that was called an autonomous region that would be akin to a Bantustan in South Africa. They have apparently had a falling out with the Philippine government. They are not, at this point, really a genuine resistance force among the oppressed Muslim minority of the Philippines.
And what about Abu Sayyaf, who he is?
Abu Sayyaf is a creation of the CIA and the Philippine Armed Forces. They were formed in Afghanistan in the late 1980s. They were one of the 7 groups created by the CIA. They returned to the Philippines. where the armed forces of the Philippines used them to split and discredit the Muslim movement. And they're continuing to use them as a pretext for outside interference in Filipino affairs.
Let's go for a minute to one of the people protesting outside the Philippine consulate. Our producer, Miranda Kennedy, spoke with Jane Orendine, a Filipina activist.
I don't feel that the that the Philippines should get involved in this war that's, you know, started by the United States. We don't empathize. The Filipinos don't empathize or sympathize with this war because we think it's not a good war. I mean, no war is good, but this is just as bad as the Vietnam War. So we would like the Philippines to not get involved in it. So since our president is in town, we figured maybe we could give her the message to deliver, but I hope we succeed.
And can you say anything about the U.S. Saying that they will do covert and overt actions in the Philippines?
Yeah, they're already having meetings there. And actually, you know, we threw the bases out a few years ago. And then when China looked like it was getting powerful, the Philippines allowed the United States to have the what they call the visiting forces. And now they've reopened the bases. And it's very dangerous because, again, just like the Japanese occupation, the Japanese came to my country not for us. They came because America was there. Okay, and now we're going to be attacked because Americans are getting involved in our country, and we don't want to get involved. We can't get involved. We don't believe in it. We don't believe in this war that America has decided to, you know, to fight. We don't want to support it with people, with money, with bases flying in and out of our country, and ships being dry docked in Subic. We just don't support it in any way.
And the Philippines has been a place for American military bases for years, is that right?
That's right. When the Americans came, and it was a condition that they set when they said that they were going to give us our independence, which we still haven't gotten, the part of that deal was the bases. And I don't know if you realize how strategically located the Philippines is. And when the United States was involved in Desert Storm, they were sending 7 fleet ships out of the Philippines to the Middle East. Okay, so we are very strategically located. We are a very desirable place for the United States to launch their wars and their planes, etc. And that's why the Philippines always comes into the picture. And plus, we've always been traditionally allies of the United States. And I don't know, I hate to sound cynical, but I really often wonder if a small, poor country like mine can actually say no to America. Just like Pakistan wasn't able to say no. A lot of people are against the war, but they're also a small, poor country. And I think if you're small and you're poor, you cannot say no to the rich countries that want to lead. And if they ask you to get involved, you have to get involved. I mean, this is a war that the Americans and the Brits, if the Brits want to fight it, fine. You know, but we don't want to be in it. We don't really want to get involved in it.
Has there been much opposition to the war in the Philippines?
Yes, there has. My entire family live there. They're very, very nationalistic. They're very political, and they're doing everything, and they're having demonstrations. And it's sort of sad because Estrada, our last president, who we ousted because his whole cabinet quit, his Senate quit, everybody quit, and he was a president without a group behind him. We were in the process of you know, sending him to jail. But then this whole war thing that the U.S. got involved in and now wants to drag the Philippines into has upstaged the whole thing with Estrada. So I hope we can still get Estrada because, you know, if we keep putting it off, he's going to get away also with all the millions of dollars that he's stolen from my people and my country.
And do you feel better about the current... Do you feel better about Arroyo?
Compared to Marcos and Estrada, yes. I mean, that's not to say a lot. Compared to a really top president like Magsaysay, I don't know. Well, during his time, probably was one of the few times that we didn't have a lot of corruption in our government. I would like to give her a chance because she's just begun. She's inherited a very difficult situation. And, you know, you have to be patient and you have to give her a chance. I would like to give her a chance. But I tell you, if she gets our country involved in this war, see, I'm sort of torn because I don't know if she can actually say no and if she would like to say no. But I would like to give her a chance. There are a lot of problems in my country, and that's why we are here. I think all the immigrants that are in this country because somehow or another the United States screwed their countries. So when people tell me to go back home, I tell them, you stop screwing my country and we will all go home. We'll be very happy to live in the third world. We will. It's better for me. I'm a woman of color. I'm like the lowest on the ladder of, you know, of people and how I get treated. I work hard. I pay my taxes. I'm a very good U.S. citizen, but I don't get treated equally. I would rather be in my poor third world country, but it's very difficult there because America's taken our resources. So that's a mouthful.
And that was Jane Orendine, a Filipina activist outside of the Filipino embassy, consulate here in New York. In our studio, we're joined by David Pugh, member of the Network in Support of the People of the Philippines. At the same time that you're protesting, there were thousands of protesters in Ottawa protesting the ministerial of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. How do you connect the issue of the, quote, war on terror with globalization?
Well, the war on terror in the Philippine context is an extension of the war, the ongoing war that the Filipino government has been waging against the Filipino people. It hasn't just been militarily, it's been economically as well. The Filipino government has allowed the U.S. to dump cheap imports into the country. It's allowed U.S. and other multinational corporations to tear up forests for mineral resources and has kept the country underdeveloped and highly profitable for the U.S. and other multinationals.
We're going to talk about globalization right now. We're going to go to a short film that documents the effects of globalization on the indigenous people in the Philippines. It was shot, produced, and directed by Filipino journalist Joey Lozano in collaboration with Witness, a nonprofit which trains and supports human rights activists to incorporate video in their advocacy. We're joined in the Firehouse studio by Sam Gregory, who is a program coordinator with Witness. Can you talk about how this film was made, just before we go to it?
Well, we've been working with Joey Lozano, who's a Philippine human rights activist and journalist, for about 6 years. And during that time, he'd been shooting footage on the island of Mindanao, documenting the impact of trade and development policy on the indigenous people there and their attempts to reclaim their ancestral lands. We'd been working with him, providing support in using video around that. And earlier this year, he came to New York to take part in an editing training in which we brought together footage from the last 6 or 7 years to try and present a panorama of the impact of what had happened on these particular communities of Tiboli, indigenous people on the island of Mindanao. So this film was the product of about 7 years of footage shot by Joey Lozano.
We're going to go to Joey Lozano right now on the telephone. Joey Lozano shot and directed and produced the film. Your reaction to President Bush meeting with the Philippine president tomorrow? Hi, you're with us?
Hi, good evening.
Hi.
This is Joey Lozano.
It's very good to have you with us. Just before we go to the film, your reaction to the meeting between the Philippine president and Bush?
Well, personally, I'm quite apprehensive on how our president would sell again the U.S. Our country, because just like President Fidel V. Ramos, who initiated so-called selling the Philippines to U.S. business, I am quite apprehensive that Gloria Macapagal Arroyo would do the same again, to the detriment of indigenous peoples in the area, because one of the major thrusts of the government right now is to open up business here in the Philippines. And most of this kind of business that she would want to be opened is forced on the agribusiness side, which means opening up indigenous people's territories to big business like multinational Dole or Del Monte.
Can you talk about the connection between the film we're about to see on globalization and President Bush and the, quote, war on terrorism?
Well, the film that I had edited with Witness is about the USAID funded road going to indigenous people's territory in Tivoli Town, a town that was named after the tribe. And it was funded by the U.S. Precisely to open up the area for the expansion of pineapple plantation. The Dole company, a subsidiary of Castle & Cook, wouldn't admit at the start that they have something to do with the expansion or with the road construction. But our research showed that the company, which opened up the area for contract growing, took advantage of the asphalted road funded by USAID, and in the long run, having opened the area to this expansion of pineapple plantation, the Tivoli tribe lost most of their lands, and even settlers lost their lands to this expansion of pineapple plantations. And well, even up to now, most of the area are planted with pineapple, and indigenous peoples, the Tivoli people, are now basically landless because of this pineapple contract growing.
Can you give us a brief history of the military bases, the U.S. military bases on the island?
Well, the U.S. military bases came as a condition to the so-called independence that the U.S. promised us. And this was abrogated. The treaty was abrogated in 1991, September 16, 1991. And because our Senate did not rejected the treaty renewal. And then after September 16, 1991, there was an attempt to reestablish the bases under the so-called Visiting Forces Agreement, which allowed the so-called temporary visit of the U.S. troops for joint military exercises, and there was huge protest against this. And now, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, according to our news reports here, is now arranging for a so-called Mutual Logistic Support Agreement, or MSLA, and this was confirmed by James Kelly himself, who is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Asia-Pacific Affairs. He confirmed in a teleconference with media at the U.S. Embassy here that the Philippine defense officials and Pentagon had been working on details of the proposed Mutual Logistic Support Agreement. And this is basically an unconstitutional act, because our constitution prohibits the use of any part of our territory for military bases, foreign military bases, I mean.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking with Filipino journalist Joey Lozano, speaking to us from the Philippines as President Bush prepares to meet with the Philippine president. Stay with us.
Strength to go through.
Judy Mowat, strength to go through here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On the phone with us, Filipino journalist Joey Lozano. As President Bush prepares to meet with the Philippine president tomorrow in Washington, D.C., we have been taking a look at the U.S. alliances with different countries, Uzbekistan, Russia, China, now the Philippines. There's very little coverage of the Philippines in the U.S. media. Since September 11th, what little coverage there's been tends to focus on the Muslim insurgency in the southern islands. But there are other stories to tell. Recently, a coalition of indigenous people on the island of Mindanao began to organize to reclaim their land, which was taken over first in the 60s by cattle ranchers and is now occupied by sugar plantations, which supply to multinational corporations. On September 6th, one of those leaders of the coalition was murdered. According to his relatives, he was targeted because of his pursuit of land claims. Later that month, the house of another prominent leader was fired on, and 2 weeks later, two others were killed. Most recently, on October 19th, an entire village was burned to the ground. Many of the people involved in the land claims lived in the village. Can you talk about this, Joey Lozano? And what is happening there?
Well, right now, just 2 days ago, I've received report from our contacts there, specifically from those we have trained to use the video, and they told me that somebody fired again a grenade launcher at the community, but fortunately, nobody was hurt. And lately, school children. Tribe members who go to school, elementary school, have stopped going to school because even the children are being harassed right now by people who are associated with sugar plantations. And so right now, it's getting worse. The situation is getting worse, and we find it quite ironic that the president, our president, is committing troops for peacekeeping forces in Afghanistan when she can't even order her policemen or her military here in the Philippines, here in Mindanao, to have a serious look or to seriously investigate what's happening in this part of our country.
We are actually showing B-roll right now for those stations that are listeners who are not only listening but watching on public access television. We are showing footage from the Philippines from the Whole Witness program. Does it make a difference to have video cameras documenting what's happening there, Joey?
Well, the tribes themselves, those whom we have trained, say they appreciate very much the video because they now could document what's happening to them as what happened just last about 2 weeks ago when we were able to document right after the ambush. We were able to document the victims, and they said with these footages they could use this as evidences against suspected perpetrators, or they could use that even as evidence against the negligence of local policemen or the local military here. And the camera gives them additional courage to go on with their struggle.
We are joined, as I said, in the studio by one of the coordinators of Witness, Sam Gregory. Can you talk about the philosophy of Witness, the footage we're showing for public access television now, in addition to the sound that our listeners on radio stations are hearing, is very powerful. How does it work? How do you get the cameras there?
The philosophy of Witness is that if you could equip grassroots human rights activists with cameras, they would be able to document right on the spot with the best knowledge what is happening in their communities. And the footage that the public access TV viewers just saw was captured moments after an ambush on these indigenous leaders It's very dramatic footage of a man who is bleeding to death, and then of the subsequent footage shows basically the scene of what happened with a young boy hiding in the bushes who was the witness to it, and they interview him. So it's this very dramatic footage straight from the moment. And it's our experience that that kind of imagery can kind of cut through the layers of bureaucracy to have a real impact. In this case, to persuade the Philippine government to act, to get TV in the Philippines to be interested and to use that footage. And hopefully going forward, we're going to work with Joey and this coalition to get attention in the US paid to this issue and to indigenous rights claims in the Philippines generally, using this the visual imagery, the stark visual imagery right from the scene.
Do you find that governments crack down when you try to get video cameras in, given what they can do when you're documenting this?
It can be a two-edged sword. Some governments will crack down. On the other hand, once the cameras are there, it's actually a disincentive to cracking down. Joey has had a number of experiences where, because he's got the camera with him there, people have not acted because they know the footage is going to get further out than, you know, than an isolated rural area in the Philippines. They know it can get out to a wider world, both in the Philippines and in the US and internationally. So I think it's two-edged. Sometimes governments will stop you, but once it's there, it can actually stop further state violence.
Hmm. Can you talk about other countries where you've used witness footage?
There's a number of other situations very similar to Joey's work. We've been working in the Honduras with minorities there, and in Mexico with a women's organization there documenting the impact of globalization on indigenous groups in Oaxaca. But we work across the range of human rights issues. So we've done work in Mexico on the treatment of people in mental facilities there, in psychiatric facilities. We've done work with forensic anthropology organizations, worked in Cambodia with organizations there doing documentation of rights abuses there. So it's really the whole range of rights issues everywhere where a video camera and visual imagery could be an important part of advocacy for a human rights activist.
Joey Lozano, you're an award-winning journalist in the Philippines focusing on human rights and environmental issues, currently a correspondent with the Philippine Daily Inquirer. Is it difficult to get your material published in the Philippines?
About a year ago, I found it very difficult to have my articles published, but fortunately now we have a new bureau chief in Mindanao now, and he's very open to receiving this kind of reports. But before, I think that generally the system in the government of the Philippine mass media industry, it's hard to get your articles on human rights violations, especially indigenous peoples. I find it hard to have these stories published because most of the mass media industry owners in the Philippines also have interest in business that has something to do with indigenous people's territories, like mining or other plantations. And that makes it hard, that makes it very difficult for people like us to have our stories published, because most owners of the mass media industry here also have interest in other businesses which has something to do with indigenous people's territories. And I'm quite thankful right now that our paper is very open with these kind of stories, and I feel I'm having a lot of encouragement to write more. Just yesterday, I wrote an article. One of my articles got published, and it was a one whole page article in the Philippine Daily Inquirer, which is the biggest broadsheet here in terms of circulation in the Philippines. And it occupied the one whole page, and to me, it's a sign that one paper here is opening up to this kind of issues, and I feel elated about this.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Joey Lozano, journalist from the Philippines with the Philippine Daily Inquirer. We're sorry we weren't able to play the film that we wanted to today on globalization, the Philippines. We hope to play it tomorrow. Just find the correct version of the video to play. But we'll go out with the protests at the Philippine consulate in New York. Again, Miranda Kennedy interviewing one of the people who were standing outside to protest and welcome the Philippine president to New York. This is Dan Wilson, who is a protest organizer with a network in support of the people of the Philippines.
Okay, yeah, I, My name is Dan Wilson. I'm a member of the Network in Solidarity with the People of the Philippines, which is a member of a larger coalition called the Inang Bayan Movement, or Motherland Movement. It's a coalition of mainly Filipino and Filipino-American organizations. And we're all concerned about the current visit of the President of the Philippines, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo. She's taken a very strong stance in favor of the U.S. war. There are U.S. officials who've talked about expanding the U.S. war to the Philippines, and she's been in full support of that. So she's here to pledge her support of the war and to ask for increased military aid to the regime in the Philippines. And we're concerned about both the expansion of the war and the support for the current war.
And that was Dan Wilson with the Network in Support of the People of the Philippines. And as we go out of our program today, news on the home front. I just came from Washington, D.C., where the Pacifica National Board had its meeting, its national meeting. There were a lot of protesters there. And amidst the protests, the Pacifica National Board went into an executive session and came out and said that they had agreed to voluntarily dissolve, that everyone on the board would resign, and that then they would reappoint themselves, reconstitute an interim board, saying that they would lead then to the democratization of the network. We're joined by one of the board members right now. Leslie Kagan is with us to explain what took place this weekend. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thanks. I'm really glad to be here. Explaining what took place this weekend is going to take a lot more time than we have right now, so we'll have to revisit this. But you make it sound like it was a very simple thing. We met, and then it happened. This is the result of many months of back and forth and back and forth, many years of protests and organizing. But essentially what happened this weekend is that those people who have been in control of the national board, the majority of the board, finally realized that the tide was turning and that they had to make a shift. We convinced them, that is the larger Pacific community and activist community, as well as the dissident board members, convinced them that they had to at least share power, even if they weren't going to totally give it up. And so we worked up a plan to move into a transitional board, which would then lead to an interim board before a new permanent board is put together. And as you said, it's based on everybody resigning. The present board members all resigning. The present board majority would name five people. The present board minority would name five people. And then each of the local advisory boards around the country would name one person to sit on this board. So there would be 15 people. There were a list of what we called hot issues that this transitional board has to deal with, including, for instance, the relationship with Democracy Now! And trying to get that back on track, sort out all the problems with the Pacifica National News and get into an honest discussion with those people who have been on strike and developed the Free Speech Radio News, try and get them back onto our airwaves. Deal with the a number of critical staffing issues. The interim national program director, do a thorough evaluation of her situation. Deal with the crisis at WBAI, set up a special committee to oversight an orderly transition at WBAI back to what we used to have here in New York, and to deal with a whole host of other issues throughout the network, including a thorough and honest and open accounting of the books. The finances are a very serious issue.
And what about the books? What have you discovered now that the executive director has been forced out?
Right. We still don't have the actual the dollar amounts, but what we understand is that there's about $300,000 in the various operating accounts of the whole network, which is not a lot of money, and $2 million in debts. Debts for day-to-day operational expenses. Above and beyond that, at least another $1 million in debts to the lawyers that the Pacifica Foundation, the previous executive director, had hired. So we're looking at probably a $2 to $3 million debt situation. This is a tremendous burden that we have to inherit it. They made a mess. We're going to have to clean it up. But to be quite honest, we'd rather clean up this mess than deal with them constantly making more and more problems.
And you're talking about lawyers to the tune of about $1 million who were hired by the majority of the Pacifica board to defend against the lawsuit of the lawsuits of you, the dissidents on the board, of listeners and local advisory boards around the country.
Exactly. But the legal bill will be much higher. It's the $1 million that hasn't been paid yet to the lawyers. We don't have an accounting yet of how much they've already been paid. So the total amount that has been paid to or owed to lawyers is going to be way over $1 million.
And then, of course, there was the one of the top PR firms in the country, well known for its representations of corporations, its founder representing Brown and Williamson against the inside whistleblower, Jeffrey Wigand. West Hill Partners, are they continuing to be employed by the Pacifica Foundation?
No, they're not. That was on our list to deal with, but it's already been dealt with because apparently we owe them, that is the Pacifica Foundation, owes them $230,000.
Roughly $250,000.
Right, so they broke that relationship. And in fact, I saw a copy of a letter from a law firm that they've hired to come after us to collect that money. So there's a lot of messes that the outgoing board majority is leaving us with.
I guess it costs a lot of money to try to put a pretty face on what has happened within our network over
years. I guess so.
Well, we are just doing this briefly today because we're going to have extended discussions about this over the next few days. It is extremely significant news about the Pacifica Foundation, our network of five stations. Again, the latest news is that the board has voted to resign, the Pacifica board, they will reconstitute themselves as an interim board with new members and then implement a democratization process for the five-station network. Hopefully, we will not remain Democracy Now in exile for much longer. Leslie Kagan, board member, thank you for being with us. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at the helm at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now in Exile. You can also go to our website at democracynow.org. Thanks to Amy Pomerleau at KPFA. Free Speech Radio News producer Aaron Glantz, Pacifica Station KPFA, affiliate station KFCF in Fresno, and all the Pacifica affiliates who are airing Democracy Now! Around the country. We are Pacifica. And thanks to Downtown Community Television, our hosts, John Alpert and Keiko Suno, and Tony Riddle of Manhattan Neighborhood Network, as well as Free Speech TV. We're broadcasting on channel 9415 of the Dish Network. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. The U.S., Islam, and terrorism. What is the state of Islam now that the U.S. has declared war on, quote, terrorism in the Middle East? We'll hear from Pakistani author and playwright Tariq Ali. As the group of 20 meets in Ottawa this weekend, many gather to discuss globalization and resistance. In New York, we'll hear from globalization expert Sylvia Federici. And the Pacifica National Board votes to disband itself. Board members will resign. A ratification vote slated for later this week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The USA Today newspaper is reporting that Defense Department strategists are building a case for a massive bombing of Iraq as a new phase of President Bush's war against terrorism. This according to congressional and Pentagon sources quoted in the paper. Proponents of attacking Iraq, spearheaded by Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, are now arguing privately that still elusive evidence linking Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's regime to the terrorist attacks of September 11th is not necessary to trigger a military strike. Meanwhile, this news from Afghanistan, the London Independent is reporting that U.S. warplanes carpet-bombed a densely populated frontline town near the northern city of Kunduz yesterday, killing up to 150 unarmed Afghan civilians. Terrified refugees fleeing the town of Khanabad yesterday told the Independent that U.S. planes had bombed the area a few miles from Kunduz daily since Thursday, seemingly oblivious to the fact that the buildings they were bombing were civilian homes. All day yesterday, huge plumes of smoke rose from the hills on the front lines near the Taliban's last northern stronghold as B-52 bombers continued to drop their loads of bombs. In the south, the Taliban remained in control of Kandahar while U.S. jets continued to pound them from the skies. The bombing raids over the past 2 days were described as among the heaviest in 43 days of U.S. attacks. U.S. officials, meanwhile, claimed intelligence had narrowed down the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden to 30 square miles in the south near Kandahar. Hundreds of U.S. Special Forces troops are combing the region looking for Osama bin Laden, coordinating U.S. airstrikes and Northern Alliance maneuvers, and engaging in direct combat with Taliban forces. The Washington Post reported yesterday the CIA has been engaged in secret combat operations in Afghanistan since September 27th. Secret CIA paramilitary units were the first U.S. forces to enter Afghanistan, preparing the way for U.S. Special Forces and providing the Northern Alliance with intelligence on the Taliban and al-Qaeda. The CIA units are part of a highly secret branch of the agency called the Special Activities Division, consisting of small teams of non-uniformed men. Many of them are veterans who have retired from the U.S. military or CIA agents who worked with the Mujahideen in the 1980s. They've been engaged in direct combat operations for nearly 2 months, and according to U.S. officials, have played a crucial role in the U.S. attacks. Talks for a broad-based Afghan government are likely to start in Europe this week after U.S. and U.N. pressure on Northern Alliance officials forced them to back off demands that power-sharing talks could only take place in Kabul. Meanwhile, militia and warlords associated with the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance have reemerged to carve up much of the country into what amounts to personal fiefdoms, posing major challenges to any efforts to restore unified central government to Afghanistan. And chanting slogans and waving banners, an estimated 100,000 people protested across London yesterday, calling for an end to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. The Stop the War Coalition, which organized the protest, said it was the largest march of its kind since the Vietnam War 3 decades ago. In Ottawa this weekend, thousands of anti-corporate globalization activists converged to protest meetings of the IMF, World Bank, and finance ministers of the G20. Police arrested 49 people in the peaceful demonstrations, which were staged to draw attention to the impact of IMF and World Bank development policies on poor countries. And in Kennebunkport, Maine, an estimated 300 people rallied this weekend in front of former President George Bush's summer home to protest the war in Afghanistan. A fourth anthrax-laced letter was sent to Senator Patrick Leahy and discovered in a batch of quarantined congressional mail last week. The letter, sent to one of the Senate's most liberal members and similar to a letter mailed to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, adds credence to federal officials' speculation that right-wing U.S. extremists may be behind the domestic biological terrorism. This news from Gaza Strip: Israeli tanks firing shells and machine guns entered Palestinian territory north of Gaza City today, killing 2 Palestinian policemen, damaging a U.S.-funded private school for Palestinian children. A large U.S. flag flew atop the building. The killings come as Bush administration officials continue to battle over the content of a speech on Middle East policy that Secretary of State General Colin Powell is scheduled to give today.
Speak to the people. Tell them what you find, 'cause when it's right, don't you feel kind of like,
yeah,
oh,
yeah,
now, oh, tell it all, truth is
gonna set you so free, come on,
we'll
y'all, come on,
tell it all, truth is gonna set you so free,
come on,
oh, y'all,
yeah, listen, just a fraction will never do what we need. All of you, forget your name, 'cause
You are listening to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. This past weekend, in addition to protests around the world, there was a major conference in New York around the issue of globalization and the war. It was called Globalization and Resistance, addressing the intersections of policies of globalization with U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and grassroots resistance to these policies. One of the speakers was London-based Pakistani author and playwright Tariq Ali. We recently had him on the telephone speaking to us from London, where he just returned from Germany after being detained by police there for carrying a book by Karl Marx. It was only after he demanded to speak to the mayor, who had recently introduced him before a crowd that he was going to speak to, that he was finally released. This is Tariq Ali this weekend speaking on the issue of U.S. Islam and terrorism.
Islam and terrorism. Well, the fact that we've got this as a title is a reflection of the world we live in, because terrorism and terrorist acts are, of course, have been known throughout the 20th century, are not restricted to Islam or any other single religion. So I'll talk about both things, but not necessarily in conjunction. I think a starting point could be as follows, that what we saw on September the 11th was the most visible form of terrorist act, probably since the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives in those cities, mainly innocent civilian lives, was also a very public act. And it was put on the screens of newsreels and shown in the cinemas and on the front pages of newspapers. And the second has been the events of September the 11th, precisely because of their incredibly dramatic character, but more importantly than that, because it happened in the United States. And what we have to understand in trying to come to grips with this event is that partially, though there's no, to try and understand and explain so that no one gets me wrong, is not to justify. It's a very, very big difference between the two things. But we have to try and come to grips with it. And simply saying it's an atrocity and denouncing it, which we do, is not enough. You have to try and get to the bottom of it. And the way I would look at it is at this, that the breach in the inviolability of the United States mainland for the first time since 1812 by a tiny group of terrorists who, in deciding to carry out this act, also decided to take their own lives, is an event of tremendous significance. But it should not allow us to forget the decades of invisible violence that preceded it. So there's visible violence, which we saw on our screens on September the 11th, and there's the invisible violence which goes on in different parts of the world and has been going on, sometimes carried out by states practicing terror backed by the United States, sometimes by so-called allies in the current alliance against terrorism like Vladimir Putin, who was, in jokey mood on the television news last night. Two men trying to crack jokes when neither of them have a sense of humor is quite a awesome sight. And what it puts a veil over is the fact that the state terror employed by Putin's government against the Chechens cost 30,000 lives. And this is a recent event, that's why I'm referring to it. It cost 30,000 lives, and Grozny was completely razed to the ground. So this was an act of semi-visible violence, because the Russians kept a very you know, close grip on the media, and only one or two very brave Russian journalists managed to get the news out of what was going on in Chechnya. And then there's the invisible violence, which has been going on in Iraq since the Gulf War, nearly 12 years now. I mean, I don't know how many people know that the amount of bombs dropped by the United States and Britain on Iraq since the Gulf War formally came to an end last year, at the end of last year, according to the figures supplied in the British Parliament by the Defense Secretary, had reached a figure which had exceeded the number of bombs dropped on Vietnam during 10 years of war. That's the scale of it. Systematic weekly bombings of so-called installations in Iraq, which, according to the inspectors, had been destroyed 10 times over. Side by side with that, according to the UNESCO figures, the sort of minimal figure, which I prefer to take because it's best if one tends not to exaggerate or take the worst figure necessarily. So let's take the lowest figure, which is that the imposition of sanctions denying the right of Iraq to import necessary medicines, necessary equipment for its hospitals, necessary sewage equipment so that the sewage tanks could be kept going after the big bombings, which was denied, that the overall impact of this was the loss of 300,000 children who've lost their lives. Now, we can't describe that as an act of terror in the literal sense of the word, because terror retained. But it is one of the most vindictive policies of social engineering carried out against a nation in modern times. You can't get rid of its leader, which is what the aim was, and you begin to destroy the people. And that's an incredibly dangerous thing to do, because the only way to get rid of dictatorships and topple them, I've always believed, has been to build the strength of the people. When Pinochet was toppled in Chile, when the Indonesian generals took over, to my recollection, no one on the left or the progressive movement ever called on the Russians or the Chinese or the Cubans to go and bomb these people or wage war to get rid of these dictatorships. No one did it because it was something which never occurred to anyone, because one knew this wasn't the way to do it, by outside interventions. And whenever there were outside interventions, they led to disasters, whoever carried them out. Soviet interventions in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, the 50s and 60s, and the disastrous Soviet intervention in Afghanistan in the 80s, which made that country the focal point of something which is carrying on to this day. So I just make these points to say that there's visible violence and there's invisible violence. And the reason that violence is invisible is not accidental either. The reason for its invisibility is because the people who own and control and dominate the means of information in modern capitalist societies also determine largely what is shown and what is not shown, which is what keeps the population as large. The level of ignorance of the population is now quite high, and it's quite interesting that the more the globalization has carried on, the less coverage there is of the rest of the world. In the 50s and 60s, there was much more coverage on news channels all over the Western world of what was going on in the rest of the world. And in a time of so-called globalization, when you actually need infinitely more coverage, it's cut down to virtually nothing. I mean, the main network news is, if you watch them now, you wouldn't know there's been a war going on in Afghanistan. I mean, you have to turn to CNN or you have to turn to BBC World to realize that. I mean, watching the news on the networks in the United States for the last 2 to 3 days, it's quite a revelation. You know, it's back to business as usual. and what's going on is going on. So I think when talking about killings and deaths and terror, one has to bear that and understand that. The second point I want to make is about Islam. Is it the case that this religion, more than any other religion, promotes terror? And I think to pose the question is really to answer it. The answer is not. Religions are interpreted in different ways by those who believe in them. All the religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam. I mean, they're Christian fundamentalists be carrying out terrorist acts, I mean, in this country against abortion clinics, just to mention one. Killing doctors. These are acts of terror. If you read what Jewish fundamentalists are doing in Israel, especially the ones who go from Manhattan and occupy settlements in territories agreed to be or demarcated as Palestinian, just the degree of violence they inflict is quite interesting. This is not to mention the state based on religious ideas, which wages a war and which uses religion, as Israel does, to not to give equal citizenships to large numbers of Palestinians. So terrorism, fundamentalism, aren't the preserve of one religion. And whether religion is even important to the people carrying out these acts is in itself an interesting question. I mean, it's just curious. The two confessional states founded in the 20th century, Pakistan and Israel, were both set up by people, their founding fathers in the case of Pakistan and their founding fathers and mothers in the case of Israel, were either agnostics or unbelievers. I mean, you look at them, Ben-Gurion, Moshe Dayan, self-declared atheist. In the case of Pakistan, Jinnah, well known to be an agnostic, he didn't talk about it too much in public, but certainly not a religious believer. So religion in these cases is used by politics, by politicians, to push certain things over. But once the basis of your state is religion, then obviously groups trying to fight you, trying to combat you, often use that religion to come up with interpretations which suit them. And it's a well-known fact about all religions that there are things in it which anyone can use from different political persuasions. I mean, the big debates which used to take place in the 60s and 70s, liberation theology in Latin America, where peasant guerrillas used to find stuff in the New Testament which they used. Similar developments in parts of the Muslim world where they found, with great difficulty, I would say, but they did manage to find some stuff which was used to say that Islam and socialism are not incompatible. Though in my opinion, Islam as the youngest of these religions and as a religion actually formed out of the needs of the merchant and trading communities of the Arabian Peninsula, in some ways is a religion much, much closer to modern capitalism and its needs than any other.
Tariq Ali, London-based Pakistani author and playwright in New York this past weekend for a conference called Globalization and Resistance. We're going to come back to his speech in just a minute here on the War and Peace Report.
There's a dream calling people, get on board.
Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers, People Get Ready, a Curtis Mayfield tune here on the War and Peace Report. This is Refugee Radio, but maybe not for much longer. The Pacifica National Board this past weekend voted that all the board members would resign. We're going to talk about the latest developments in a little while on this program, but right now we're going to go back to the speech of Tariq Ali, who is a London-based Pakistani author and playwright, speaking about the U.S., Islam, and terrorism.
And studies what they say. And if one even looks at how rewards and punishments are meted out at the end of Islamic theology and mythology by God on the Day of Judgment, it's almost if God is a merchant. He's putting everything in the balance. Good here, bad there. You've done so much good, so many good deeds. You've done so many bad deeds, punishments. If you read it, it reads like a merchant's ledger. So it's quite interesting. Now, this is very little to do with terror, and it's a very interesting debate on the, you know, we can have on the origins of Islam and its development. But coming to this gang, Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, which I'm sure is what people want to discuss. You know, where did they grow out of? Who are they? Why did they grow at the time that they did? And the answer was supplied very clearly by, I mean, it's not even denied now that these groups were largely created, helped, funded, financed, trained, armed by the United States. In the 80s, when they were fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, and Carter's national security advisor, Brzezinski, admitted as much in an interview he gave to a French magazine a few years ago. He went through the whole business quite openly, actually, refreshingly so, and said, yeah, well, I think it was 5 years ago. He said, we did create these groups, we did align with them. In fact, Brzezinski stood on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan wearing a Pashtun turban and saying, Allah is on your side, go and wage the jihad, which, you know, they did. One of the first acts, incidentally, of Osama bin Laden and his group when they invaded Afghanistan was to attack a school where boys and girls were being taught together, destroying that school and executing the head teachers. No one raised a murmur of criticism in the West at the time. In fact, newspapers had been given instructions, certainly in Britain, to make sure that you refer to these people all the time as freedom fighters. And when Brzezinski was asked after this, asked about this 5 years ago, his reply was quite revealing. He said, what are a few jumped up Muslims when you compare it to the fact that we brought the Soviet Empire down? And okay, he said it before September the 11th. 2 days ago, I was debating this United States journalist, I don't know whether you've heard of him, Charles Krauthammer, on Canadian television. We had a one-hour debate, and I raised this point with him. This is now, yesterday, 2 days ago, and Krauthammer said, well, I agree with Brzezinski, you know. Why should we apologize? We aligned ourselves with the devil to defeat a greater devil. I'm not going to make any apologies. And I said, well, I think you owe the people of New York an apology for that. Because the point is that throughout the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, the United States, which was combating during the Cold War years, parties of the left, secular nationalists, not just communists, secular nationalists, Nasser in Egypt, Qasem in Iraq, Sukarno in Indonesia, basically said, which are the forces in these countries we can use to combat our enemies, and found in Islam a bulwark which they could use. And they used to say Islam is the bulwark against communism. And they used them and they funded them. All the religious parties in Egypt and Pakistan were funded by the United States, either directly or using Saudi Arabia as a conduit. So these things haven't dropped out of a clear blue sky. They have a past. And having created this mess over the last 30 years, it's what the CIA, the term the CIA coined was blowback. It is unfortunately the blowback effect of that. Now, why some of these groups have become popular is what I was saying earlier today, that in some countries, they have utilized a rhetoric and raised issues which no one else is raising because of the collapse of the left, because of the collapse of secular politics, and because of the fact that most of the politicians in these countries are venal and unable to resist anyone, not just the United States, any Western power, anyone who gives them money is fine. And this is creating an anger and a bitterness in these countries. And the result of that is that in the vacuum that exists, some of people veer towards these currents because they offer change. And they offer the kingdom of God, which will be a just kingdom. Now, you and I can say we know it won't be because we've seen where they've come to power, what they've done. But in many parts of the world where people are still incredibly poor, alienated, angry, embittered, dispossessed, they feel that why not give these guys a chance? They haven't had one. Now, it's very interesting. You can see a very interesting changes. In Pakistan, where you had state-sponsored fundamentalism through the years of the Zia military regime, General Zia, very squalid little military dictator in Pakistan from 77 to 1988, backed by the United States and the West as a whole, solidly from beginning to end, created Islamic fundamentalist groups, put them on the payroll of military intelligence, armed them, trained them, funded them. Because in Pakistan itself, religious fundamentalism was a tiny, tiny minority. It's now a slightly larger minority. But in the last three general elections that have taken place in Pakistan, the religious parties have got less than 5% of the vote. Less than 5%. So basically, the population in Pakistan doesn't vote for these people. And partially it's because their tradition never existed then. Largely it's remembering how these groups were created and built during the Zia dictatorship. In Algeria, the situation sadly is different. Though even there, very interesting books are now coming out showing how the FIS, the FIS, the largest Islamic group, was actually created to try and marginalize the left forces inside the FLN. And that some of the right wing within the FLN was playing games with the FIS initially to try and marginalize their radical opponents. That's how the process started there. In Palestine, we know that the Israelis encouraged Hamas right at the beginning to try and marginalize the forces of the left and secular nationalism. Saudi Arabia, well, it's a totally different story, as we discussed this morning. This is a state whose state religion is a very virulent minority sect known as Wahhabism, a sect which was formed in the 18th century by a local preacher trying to raise the tribes to fight against the Ottoman Empire, which was a Muslim empire. The head of the Ottoman Empire was the Caliph of Islam, the supreme ruler of Islam. And in order to struggle against him, they devised a way of attacking him in a way which mobilized people, saying he's betrayed Islam. Look, they drink, they fornicate, they're sensual, they're this, they're that. So the struggle against the Ottomans took on a very puritanical and revivalist fervor. But it only, I mean, it was in the Arabian Peninsula that this stuff began and linked up with the largest tribal rulers, and these tribal rulers were handed power in the 40s by Aramco, the oil giant. And so Wahhabism is the state religion in Saudi Arabia. And the role the Saudi government has played in furthering this particular current and religious extremism needs to be documented further. There isn't enough documentary evidence published, but it exists on exactly what they did. So the point I'm making is that this stuff is what's been going on has much more to do with politics than religion. Religion has been used, as all religions can be used, and therefore it's best to see the thing as such and not fall into the trap of wars, you know, civilization wars, Islamic civilization versus Christian civilization, etc., or the West versus the rest. Because, I mean, all these things basically are going to enhance the problem, not deal with it. And the last point, and on this I will end, that one of the most interesting developments anywhere in the Islamic world we're seeing is in Iran today. Why are we seeing it in Iran? Because you've had a generation which has grown up under the Islamic Republic, or a generation, almost two generations. We have people who, I can't remember the statistics now, but I think the figures are that over 70% of the population is under 30 years of age. So the bulk of the country has grown up under the Islamic Republic. And all the information you get is that there is a growing hostility and anger against the practice of Islam and against the theocratic dictatorship which was implemented in that country. And because people are allowed to vote and do vote, they vote for what they are offered within the system. And incidentally, the percentages of people who voted in Iran in the last two general elections are 80% and higher compared to some Western countries. And they have voted for what they regard as the reform candidates. And it's very interesting that some of the movies which are coming out of Iran, what we see in them and what they reflect of the culture that has been existing clandestinely, and some of it is now going to come into the open. So it would be a supreme irony, but a very delightful one, if the reformation which Islam has been denied for centuries historically actually started in contemporary Iran. And on that note, I'll stop.
And that was Tariq Ali, the Pakistani author and playwright, wrote NATO's Balkan Adventure and The Stone Woman and Islamic Quintet. He was speaking this weekend in New York at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, at a major conference called Globalization and Resistance. And if you'd like to find out about getting a videotape of this speech, as well as the next we're going to play, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. We're going to go to our break early. When we come back, we'll hear from Sylvia Federici on globalization as thousands of anti-corporate globalization activists gathered in Ottawa this weekend with scores of arrests. And then we'll find out the latest news on the home front. We'll find out about the Pacifica board voting to resign. Stay with us.
Just
Star, Stop the War Now, here on the War and Peace Report. This is Refugee Radio, Resistance Radio. This is Free Speech Radio, Democracy Now! In Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the speeches from the Globalization and Resistance Conference held this past weekend at the City University of New York, the Graduate Center, as this was taking place here in New York, several thousand protesters went to Ottawa to protest the top-level finance ministers' meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. That the combined meetings of the group of 20, the IMF and World Bank, terrorism was a major issue. The G20 resolution calls for implementing relevant UN Security Council resolutions, freezing the assets of terrorists and their associates, and denying them access to the international financial system. It's interesting to note that those entities that have most opposed the freezing of assets have been major U.S. banks like Citibank, Chase, and J.P. Morgan. Police arrested 49 people at the demonstrations, charging most with public mischief or breach of the peace. Two were charged with assaulting police officers. All but four had been released by yesterday afternoon. Police fired tear gas, pepper spray, plastic or rubber bullets, and bean bags, and doused the crowd with water. We're going to turn now to Sylvia Federici, Associate Professor in Political Philosophy at Hofstra University and coordinator of the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa. She spoke as part of the Globalization Resistance Conference.
This plenary, it's raising the issue of alternatives to globalization and war. And one of the first points that I want to make is that we have to begin to develop a thinking that sees globalization as war as one process, and not as two separate threats that are undermining peace in the world and the movements for liberation that have been waging it. War today is one of the major pillars and one of the major tools of globalization. This is very, very important. And an anti-globalization movement that does not make the struggle against war at the center of it is doomed to be defeated. For instance, war today is used to expropriate. In fact, it's been used over the last two decades or more to expropriate millions of people from their land, force them off their countries, force them off their communities. War has been one of the main instruments, together with debt and the politics of structural adjustment, to separate millions of producers from the means of production. And in fact, those of us who, during the war against Yugoslavia, fought against the war, we said, we told people, we can't accept this. We have to struggle against this war. This is globalization. This is globalization. Also predicted at the time that something like what has happened after September 11 would take place. We couldn't tell how, but it was very clear at that point, as they were bombarding Yugoslavia, Serbia, and they were destroying the infrastructure of Serbia, for instance, to pave the way to liberalization process. We said, in fact, this is just the beginning, because just looking at the plans, reading the reports of the Rand Corporation and so forth, you could really see that there was a plan unfolding, which was leading, in fact, very much in the same direction that we see the American troops moving now. Because it seems to me that when all is said and done, the bombs that are now falling on Afghanistan and the big mobilization that is being organized around it have very little to do with Osama bin Laden and a lot to do with the militarization of Central Asia and militarization which has already been in the plan. There's a lot of material that you can read. Already during the Clinton administration, this was in the cards. Already there were reports that basically spoke saw a role for NATO as going from the shores of the Atlantic up to the outskirts of Moscow. So it's very important that this time in the future we do not have the ambiguities and confusion that, you know, seems to me plague also the anti-globalization movement a few years ago when the issue was not Central Asia, but it was Yugoslavia. The second point that I want to make is about the alternative. I want to say that, you know, we have to think of the alternative, not as something that we have to invent or imagine, right? Although imagination is always very important, but we have to apply our imagination to what is already present now in the struggle. In other words, the alternative has already been built. It's already been built across the world in the many struggles that people are making against globalization. And the question is to see, you know, where those struggles are leading and what are the directions that are most important, most promising. Now, here it seems to me I want to mention some of those directions that are very, I think, are very important. And then they're very crucial in terms of, you know, my conception of where there is hope, where there is growth. First, if you look today worldwide, and not just only today, but the last few decades, you know, it's very clear that across Asia, Africa, South America, there is a movement that an anti-globalization movement that is gaining momentum and that more and more has been fighting not only against the World Bank, the IMF, and WTO, but has also been fighting for reparations, has also been fighting for reappropriation of what has been stolen from the people of the Americas, what has been stolen from the people of Africa and Asia. And that reparation movement, it's a movement that starts, if I can say so, from two basic principles. One is the principle that Fanon has taught us, that you cannot really build a new society unless you have the resources to do so. That you cannot build a new society unless you begin to reclaim what is being taken away from you. And second, that along this line, one of the first things that people across the globe have to do on the way to a new political millennium is to make capitalism pay for all that they've taken away from people, make them pay the debt that they have. Because unless this debt is paid, it is going to continue to function as a means of enslavement. So this is the time, in fact, in which people across the globe, and I think that this is very important, there's a lesson which we all have to reflect, from the indigenous people of Mexico and the Americas, to the farmers of India, to grassroots women movement in Africa and other in parts of Asia. Basically, what the people are saying is that what capitalism has done, it has taken away the means of livelihood, it has created slavery on a mass scale, and that slavery is still present today. The fact that they have not paid, that this has not been redressed, right? It's still there. It still creates new forms of slavery. And in fact, this is very clear, it's very evident. One of the ways in which the neoliberal agenda is being justified, particularly in its application to third world countries, is basically to say, look, we gave you a chance. We have no responsibility for your poverty. We gave you a chance to become independent. We gave you a chance to create your own nations. And look at the mess that you've made of it. Right? Look at the mess that you've made of it. And on that, along those lines, the World Bank, IMF, have been able to speak, for instance, of an African debt. Right? An African debt. Now, an African debt, the notion of an African debt, And we can extend that concept also to other parts of the third world that have been colonized. But the notion of an African debt is an abomination. It's a true abomination. Because in fact, who owes what to whom? Who owes what to whom? How do they dare to speak of an African debt? How do they dare to speak? And so it's very important because there has to be, this is a time in which history has been made to be present. More than ever, you know, history has to be called and has to be really brought to the present of our struggles. The people are saying, no, we cannot move on. We cannot move forward to a new society unless we first deal with what has been done to us, unless we first deal with what has been taken away from us. And this is also happening in the United States. I imagine the man in Maribor, we speak to it. A week ago, there has been at City College a conference on reparations, which many, many, many people now begin to see has the culmination, in fact, of black people's struggle all through this century. And again, taking this explicit name, reparation, at a time when in the US, as well as on a planetary level, basically our bosses are saying, you know, you are poor because you deserve to be poor. We have no responsibility for your poverty, right? We have no responsibility for your poverty. And so, you know, this movement is again very important because it's the only way in which not only people can deal with the slavery of the past, but the only way also where the slavery is not to be continued in the present, at a time in which more and more the world economy is going to look like a plantation economy. I want to make another couple of points, which is that together with the discussion about reparation, it's also very important what is happening, still coming from grassroots movement, both in across the third world, but also in our metropolitan areas, in the US, in Europe, particularly among movements, women's movements, and movements, anarchist movements, ecological movements, green movements, that are putting on the agenda and the question of reappropriation of the means of production, but particularly also the question of another form of production, right? Another form of production not based on a capitalistic use of natural resources, right? We see today there is a continuity between movements in India, women's movements that, for example, you know, oppose logging or oppose the spread of genetically engineered plants, with the movements, for example, in Europe, in the US, you know, around garden, around against bioengineering of agricultural products, and in general, a movement that puts on the agenda the construction of societies that are self-sufficient, that are not based on continuous growth or the continuous and increasingly global exchange of products. I think that this is a very promising direction that again begins to restore control into people's hands of again the means of production and the means by which we can, you know, control our lives. The last thing I want to say is that we don't have to be, we have to be very concerned, of course, with the repression that is going to come and is already coming against the anti-globalization movement. Of course, we have to be very, very concerned. On the other hand, we also have to consider then the struggle against globalization has perhaps been the strongest in countries that have had experienced a repression far, far worse than what is on the agenda now. And among groups that have been targeted by the state and already have lived for years in a state of emergency. Right? For the black population in the United States, repression is not a novelty. Mm-hmm. Right? Repression is not a novelty. We are afraid now because our civil liberties have been eroded. But the reality is that for millions of Americans, those civil liberties have disappeared quite a while ago. And yet, we have seen that they have not ceased to struggle. And in fact, in the very midst of a time in which the movement is being demoralized, you know, that struggle is being revitalized in very, very powerful ways. So I think that right there, there's something from which we can take strength.
Sylvia Federici, speaking this weekend at a Globalization and Resistance Conference at the City University of New York. She is an assistant professor at Hofstra University, as thousands of people were protesting in Ottawa against the World Bank and the IMF. Close to 50 people there were arrested. And if you'd like to get information on getting a video cassette of today's speeches, Tariq Ali and Sylvia Federici, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. And today we go out with information on the home front, on major developments in the Pacifica Foundation. I've just returned from Washington, D.C., where the national board meeting of Pacifica took place this past weekend, where the Pacifica National Board agreed to resign en masse. Leslie Kagan is here, one of the board members, to talk briefly about these developments. Welcome, Leslie.
Hi, it's great to be here, too, and especially to be here and talk about this. You're absolutely right. The 10 of the board people who were there this weekend did vote unanimously. We totally agreed to step down and to replace ourselves with what we're calling a transitional board, made up of 5 people appointed by the outgoing board majority, 5 people appointed by the outgoing board minority, and then 5 people that would come from one each from the local advisory boards around the country. I should be clear on this, that those people who have been in the board majority and those of us who have been in the board minority or the dissident group within the board might be in the new 5 that come on. I'm sure that many of us will be, in terms of just assuring some continuity and being able to deal with the many problems. This transitional board has been mandated, or will be mandated, with responsibilities to handle all kinds of things, from lifting the gag orders to getting charges dropped against people here in New York and as well as in Houston who've been arrested in the course of this struggle.
In terms of the protests.
Yes, protests in order to get Pacifica back on track, as well as sorting out the relationship with Democracy Now and getting Democracy Now! Broadcast on all 5 stations.
You mean we'll no longer have to say Democracy Now! In exile?
Well, it was very interesting. One of the issues that was raised was, well, what about that tagline and saying you're in exile and the fired and the banned? So, you know, I said, well, as long as that situation exists, you're going to say that. But once that situation doesn't exist anymore, then I imagine the tagline would go.
So what have you found out in the course of this weekend? You have a Pacifica board that is resigning. You're going to replace yourselves, 5 majority members, 5 minority members, as you've been called. You have 3 lawsuits against the Pacifica Foundation,
right?
Listeners, local advisory boards, and you among them, dissident members, suing the other part of the board. What happens with these lawsuits?
Right. The one thing that it is important for people to be clear about is that this is an agreement that does not automatically settle the lawsuits. One of the other tasks that this transitional board is charged with is now to settle the lawsuits. We're assuming that with this transition going through, that it will be much easier, much quicker to settle the lawsuits and bring us all, you know, out of that incredible nightmare of dealing with the lawyers and the courts and everything else. And what one of the things that we're hoping to recoup during the course of the actual settlement of the lawsuits is some of the money that has been spent outrageously. With one interesting fact that we learned this weekend, although I haven't seen the actual dollar figures, is that the outgoing board majority has left us with a debt of somewhere between $2 and $3 million. And we hope to recoup some of that money.
This is just a $12 million organization?
Yes, this is averages about a $12 million annual budget. So that's a tremendous debt. I'm not opposed to,
another million spending. For lawyers?
The $2 million is in operational expenses. The another over $1 million in lawyers' fees that are still to be paid, not previously paid lawyers' fees and legal fees. We asked, well, when you say over $1 million, are we talking about 1.1 or 1.2 or 1.8 million? And we couldn't get a straight answer on that yet either.
And the PR firm most recently hired by Pacifica?
Yes, West Hill Partners, a very prestigious, right-wing kind of firm, or a firm that certainly represents right-wing clients, has that relationship has already been severed. And in fact, they've hired lawyers to try and put a claim on over $230,000, nearly $250,000, that apparently we owe them.
So the board will reconstitute as 5 minority members, 5 majority members, and 5 chosen by the local advisory boards, and then the local advisory boards will have to hold local elections.
Yes, and one of the other large mandates to this transitional board is to conduct elections for new local advisory boards.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We've purposely cut this short because we're going to do a major piece on this later in the week, and we hope to be back on all of the Pacifica stations. Leslie Kagan, a Pacifica board member. That does it for the program. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We're broadcasting on WBIX.org, where Errol Maitland is, along with Reem Kathuda. And you can hear us and see us at democracynow.org, where you can also email us at mail@democracynow.org. Special thanks to Robert Weiss for recording today's speeches. We're broadcasting from the Downtown Community Television. Thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Suno, and to Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Tony Riddle. You can hear us on WFMU in New York, 91.1 FM, every night at 7 o'clock. Manhattan Neighborhood Network, channels 34 and 56. Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of the Dish TV. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Yeah. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level.
We have more breaking.